If you're wondering why we're starting the talk without having read the Bible, I'm going to ask Murray to come and read bits as we go through, because we've got two different readings coming up, and it will come to them in the talk when we get to that point. So, I wonder if you ever find yourself thinking, if only. Things would be really quite different if only, dot, 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 fill in that own bit yourself. We say to ourselves, if only I'd slept better, then I wouldn't be so grumpy. If only I had a demanding spouse, whatever it is, then I'd get fit. If only I wasn't so unwell, well, I'd be able to do so much more. If only I wasn't so busy, then I could have more time for God. If only. I wonder what your if onlys are at the moment. If only can be a great reason for a whole host of things, can't it? Or do I actually mean if only can be a bit of an excuse? Isn't it easy to blame circumstances, something over which we have no control, for our behaviour and our choices, things over which we do have control? And I wonder if your if only came true, how would things be changed? If you had real freedom, what would your life look like? How would you do things differently? It's an interesting question, isn't it? And my suspicion is that perhaps things might not be as different as they currently are. And I think as we dive into God's word this morning, we'll see that for God's people in the Old Testament as well. But before we move into our new section today, I'm going to have a quick recap of where we've been. We began in Genesis, the first book of the Old Testament, seeing the origin of all things. We saw that the Bible declares that God is before everything. He designed and created all things, and he made human beings in his own image. But we also saw how quickly humans turned away from God. They used their freedom, but to turn away. Adam and Eve got thrown out of the Garden of Eden, evil entered the world, and things spiraled downwards. Then in the second half of Genesis, we saw God take the initiative to restore things. He called Abraham and made these great promises to him, that he would make him a great people, he'd give him a great place, and they would pour out his blessing through him on the whole world. God's people in God's place under God's blessing. Sounded amazing. Perhaps Eden could be restored. And by the beginning of the second book in Exodus, God's people were certainly numerous. That was the first promise being fulfilled. But they were still slaves in a foreign land. Not so good for promises 2 and 3. And then so 2 weeks ago, James looked with us at the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers and Deuteronomy, the Bible books 2 to 5. And we saw the dramatic way in which God rescued his people from slavery in Egypt. How he brought them out for the Passover and crossing the Red Sea. And that God made that great covenant, the great promise with them. Think the Ten Commandments and all those other laws, including building a visible sign of God's presence with them, the Ark of the Covenant. This time, think Ark in terms of box rather than in terms of a boat. And it's in this part of the Bible, mostly in Leviticus, that we met the role of a priest, someone who would stand between the sinful people and a holy, great God and enable them to approach him. We discover that God is holy and perfect. We can't just wander into his presence. We need to be clean if we're going to approach our awesome God. And then finally, after 40 years, took so long because of their disobedience, under Joshua, the people of God arrived in the promised land, which is where we're going to pick things up today. Perhaps now, being rescued and brought into the promised land, things might begin to go well. Could this be the fulfillment of those promises, God's people in God's place, under God's blessing? So today, we're going to take a look at books 6 to 11. In the Old Testament, the history books of Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Kings, and very briefly mentioned Bible books 18 to 22, the wisdom books of Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes and Song of Songs, which are in the same time period. Not much. So I hope you're sitting comfortably. But it's my hope that as we do this fleeting visit, that we will understand ourselves better and see just why it was that Jesus had to come and why we need him so desperately. Now, the book of Joshua gives the story of the Israelites conquering the promised land. It's another story of great miracles, the crossing of the River Jordan, the defeat of Jericho. And it's a story of blessings for obedience and the seriousness of disobedience. And it ends with Joshua giving the Israelite people a stark choice. Will they follow God, who has brought them this far, or will they choose the local gods of the people they've just conquered? He says, choose for yourself whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And it's a good question to ask ourselves today. Whom will we serve? Imagine you have a clean slate, a life with no responsibilities, no one dragging you down, nothing to put you off course. Whom will you serve? Well, let's see what happened to the Israelites. Here they are, shiny, clean, new people, set free in a new land, new laws, a new start. It's the book of Judges. Over to Murray for our first reading, if you want to come up here. Thank you.
Our first reading is from Judges 2, verses 16 to 19. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. They quickly turned from the ways of their ancestors, who had been obedient to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies, as long as the judge lived. For the Lord relented because of their groaning under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their ancestors, following other gods and serving and worshipping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways.
Oh, what a disappointment. The tragic story of Judges is that when the newly rescued people of God settle in their new promised land, their new freedom does not lead them to choose well. Instead, we get this downward spiral, a cycle that goes round and round again. Israel forget God, they do evil, they fall into sin. God allows their enemies to triumph over them. Then they call out to God in desperation. God raises up a judge, a rescuer, a leader who will rescue them from their enemies. They're saved. They temporarily serve the Lord, and then they forget and turn away. And the cycle goes round and round in the book of Judges. I wonder if that rings any bells with you, either for yourself perhaps or for the people that you know, people who start off serving God but drift away into a God-free lifestyle. Then crisis hits and all of a sudden that person calls out to God, promising to serve him faithfully, and God does come through. He does work powerfully in their life and they follow him again, but soon they drift off again and the cycle begins. Even with God blessing our lives, sometimes it doesn't seem to be enough. And that was the story for the Israelites. They were God's people in God's land, but they just couldn't live in a way and receive his blessing. They kept choosing their own path. And it's a really ugly story. If you want to read an 18 book, this is the one. It's really unpleasant. Read it and weep how low God's people fell. Freedom was not enough. They might have had freedom from slavery in Egypt. They might have received God's laws at Mount Sinai. They might have got God's presence with them in the Ark of the Covenant. But they were far, far from living as God's people in the new land. Somehow none of that was enough. They still desperately needed help. Before the nation's narrative carries on into the book of 1 Samuel, we come to the little book of Ruth. Looking with our big picture lens, the story of Ruth introduces King David's family into the big story. But in itself, it's a wonderful story of faithful friendship and hope. It's a ray of beauty in stark contrast to the ugliness of the book of Judges that comes before it. And then we come on to the books of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Kings. Samuel is the last of the judges, these spirit-filled leaders that God raises up to meet a need. And Samuel was a good leader, but his sons didn't follow his ways, and the Israelite people decided that they'd actually much rather be like the other nations around them and have a king. God was supposed to be their king, but the people wanted a human king, and God permits their request. And so he calls Samuel to anoint Saul. From all appearances, Saul is a great choice. He comes from a good family, he's tall, he's handsome, he's got everything going for him. But he soon proves to be far from perfect on the inside. Insecurity, pride, anger, these take over and God removes his blessing. And while Saul remained king for quite a while, God called Samuel to anoint David with oil, marking him out, David, to be the next king. Humanly, David was a rather unlikely candidate, the youngest of eight sons, a mere shepherd boy, but God's choice. As God said to Samuel, people look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Now, Paul tells us in Acts chapter 13 that after removing Saul, God made David their king. God testifies concerning him, I have found David, son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. He will do everything I want him to do. This seems to be the one. And so David becomes a great national hero. No doubt we've heard of the story of David and Goliath and the little boy who trusts God and uses just a stone to take out the mighty Philistine hero. David continues to learn to trust God through really tough years when Saul is still king and pursuing him and trying to kill him. And eventually David is crowned king by his own tribe, the Jew of Judah, and then later by all the 11 other tribes. The nation of Israel is formed, and David leads them to defeat all the surrounding enemies. He chooses the city of Jerusalem to become the new capital, and this city becomes the symbol of God's presence among them, the city of Zion, that's its other name. And it looks like, finally, God's people can live in God's land under God's blessing. Could this be the time when all those promises are going to come right? It looks like things will work out. But David feels uncomfortable. God's dwelling place is still in a tent. The Ark of the Covenant is still in the portable transport that they did in Exodus. And it doesn't seem to fit with this new capital city and his new temple, his new palace for himself and the new prosperity. So David decides that he's going to build God a permanent house, a new temple to replace the tent. So now we're going to hear our second reading of what God has got to say about David's good idea.
Our second reading comes from 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 4, and then verses 8 to 16. But that night the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, Now then, tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from the pasture, from tending the flock, and appointed you ruler over my people Israel. I have been with you wherever you have gone, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. Now I will make your name great, like the names of the greatest men on earth, and I will provide a place for my people Israel, and will plant them so that they can have a home of their own, and no longer be disturbed. Wicked people shall not oppress them any more, as they did at the beginning, and have done ever since the time I appointed leaders over my people Israel. I will also give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with the rod wielded by men and floggers inflicted by human hands. But my love will never be taken away from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from you before. Your house and your kingdom shall endure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever.
Thank you, Murray. So David has this great plan to build a nice big house for God, but actually God says, no. You want to build me a house? Actually, that's your son's job. I am going to build a house, a family line for you. God says he's going to build the house of David, not physically, but in terms of people and offspring. God will establish this family and this kingdom forever. Now, if you've got the passage in front of you, do have a look at it again. Aren't there some amazing promises there? God's going to establish David's family line. God's going to raise up from his family someone whose kingdom will be forever. That promised one from David's line. God's going to be his father. His love will never be removed. He'll be God's son. Ringing bells of something that we know more about yet? God says, you and your house and your kingdom shall endure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. Sounding so much like the promises of God will now work out. Perhaps all that the people had needed was the right good king. They'd already got the priests, hadn't they, who'd make the sacrifices and the law to let them come to God. Now they've got a good king to lead them. Perhaps that would be enough, and Eden could be restored now. But as you heard a hint within that passage, talked of wrongdoing, didn't it? That hope was soon dashed. Despite being described as a man after God's own heart, David still had big flaws and turns out to be far from an ideal leader. 2 Samuel goes on to tell the sordid story of his adultery with Bathsheba, her subsequent pregnancy, and his arranging the murder of her husband to cover it all up. And from that moment, the rest of his life is frankly a bit of a mess. He does realize his error, he does repent, he does cry out to God, and he is forgiven. But the consequences of his foolishness and other more foolish choices he continues to make have just destroy the whole situation. His children from his different wives destroy each other and nearly destroy the kingdom. The ugliness of humanity is still very much alive and kicking. Now, interestingly, God chooses the next king to be his son Solomon. But this is a child from David's marriage to Bathsheba, of all people. As we saw so much in Genesis, God so often works for good through our mess and our mistakes. Something that we think could be not redeemed, God works through in power. And again, at first, Solomon seems to be a fabulous choice. Perhaps he's the king they were looking for. When God says to him in the dream, I want you to ask for whatever you want, Solomon asks for wisdom. And because he chooses so well, God also promises him riches and honor. And so the golden age of Israel begins. Peace, prosperity, world recognition. People come from all over the world to pay homage to King Solomon and his wisdom. And this is where those Bible books of Job, Proverbs, Psalms, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Songs fit in. They're called the wisdom books, and they're a really different style to all the books we've been looking at so far. They're songs, prayers, proverbs, poetry, reflection, in contrast to the telling of history. And these books, these wisdom books, address life from a very different perspective, and they give us biblical wisdom in a whole host of ways. A lot of the material is from the pen of David and Solomon with others, and they're very influential in David and Solomon in this whole area of wisdom literature. So King Solomon gets to be known for W's, wealth, wisdom, and also worship, for he is the one, as God said, who would go ahead and build the temple that David had planned. With all this right now, could this be the time for God's final fulfillment of his promises? 1 Kings 4 records this, the people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore, linking back to that promise in Genesis. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. Was this the time? But no. In spite of all these blessings, all this freedom, the ugliness of humanity is still there. Because Solomon has another W associated with him, women. 1 Kings 11, 3 and 4 says this, Solomon had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. Can you go back, please? Thank you. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of his father David had been. Now, I've got to be honest. When I get to heaven, this will be something I'm asking God. How can somebody so wise be such an idiot? Having 1,000 sexual partners, wives. Doesn't sound very wise to me. Anyway, clearly it wasn't. It led him away from God, despite all the blessings he'd received from God. Solomon used his freedom to turn away. Human ugliness, even to the one who'd been